All right, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. So I am going to tell you a bit about the results that you've probably heard a lot about already, the binary black holes detected by LIGO during its first observing run. I'm going to give you kind of some of the details that go behind the analysis, how we go about characterizing these things, and then kind of more about the science that I'm really excited to do, being a part of LIGO and being a part of these detections and kind of what the future looks like. So the key science questions that really drive the kind of work that I do are really focused around compact binaries and general relativity. I want to figure out how compact binaries are formed, the kinds of environments that they're formed in, and using along the way gravitational waves to do both of those things, as well as test general relativity in the strong field regime and figure out where deviations may be happening and start to put interesting constraints on them. So the brief outline of my talk, I'm going to give a very, very, very brief gravitational wave primer. I'm going to assume you've heard a lot about this over the last year. Then I'm going to give some of the details behind compact binary detection and characterization methods used within LIGO, how we detect these compact binary gravitational wave signals, how we go about characterizing the binaries that emitted them. And then I'm going to talk about where we can go from there, what these detections will teach us about astrophysics, formation channels for compact binaries, and then constraints that we can place on deviations from general relativity using these same detections. So I've been incredibly involved with LIGO's first observing run. So I've been in the collaboration since 2008. I've gotten my hands into a lot of stuff. I'm not going to have time to go into all the details and all the things that I contributed during the first observing run. So this is just kind of a brief summary slide of all of the figures that I helped generate for all of the papers published at the end of the first science run. And I just want to put this up there to give you an idea of what aspects in the collaboration I'm involved in. And if you see anything that I don't talk about, please don't hesitate to ask me questions or talk with me after. I'd love to talk more about it. But briefly, so up here, the original discovery paper, this is LIGO's flagship gravitational wave discovery paper, detecting GW150914. I was involved with the kind of hallmark figure there, the money plot that shows the signal and all of the characteristics of it, and the constraints placed on specifically the masses and spins of the black holes that we detected. I was co-editor of the GW151226, the second confident detection. I was the co-editor of that discovery paper and produced all these figures for it. This was my main paper. This is the paper that goes into all of the details about GW150914 and the characterization of that source. So how we estimated all of the interesting parameters of that binary, the masses, the spins, some deviations from general relativity, et cetera. Also involved with the testing GR paper for GW150914. I produced most of the figures for the 01 summary BBH paper, so summarizing all of the binary black holes detected in the first observing run, and then some details about unmodeled constraints of GW150914. So if I don't talk about any of these aspects, please don't hesitate to ask questions either during the talk or after. I'd love to talk more about them. So gravitational waves, one slide. They are these strains produced in space-time that travel great distances, unimpeded by matter, traveling at the speed of light, caused by a time-changing quadrupole moment. So binary systems, as they inspiral and emit gravitational waves, are a prime candidate for producing strong gravitational waves that we can detect here on Earth. The fact that they travel unimpeded by matter and they scale with the distance means that they are a great probe of systems very far away that are often not emitters of electromagnetic light. So they give us truly a complementary window onto the universe, give us a direct way to observe compact objects and specifically black holes and do really, really interesting science that we can do in no other way. Gravitational waves, just like electromagnetic waves, exist on a spectrum. So far, we've just entered the gravitational wave regime at the high frequency end. So ground-based detectors here on Earth, due to limits at low frequency from seismic noise and limits at high frequency from just photon counting statistics, place us around 100 hertz in sensitivity. And so at that regime, that's where we start to detect stellar mass compact objects and spiraling into one another, so neutron stars and black holes. Once we get away from Earth, if you go to space with things like LISA, you can start probing lower frequencies. So then you start scaling up the masses of compact objects you can detect, so supermassive black holes, as well as some stellar mass objects still. And then going to lower frequencies yet, you get to pulsar timing using pulsars as precise clocks with a long baseline for your gravitational wave detector detecting very low frequency gravitational waves, and then all the way at the lowest frequency end is looking at primordial gravitational waves as imprints in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. And so that's where you get to B modes and the BICEP2 type measurements. So compact objects, this is where my focus remains, and specifically stellar mass objects, binary neutron stars, black hole neutron stars, and binary black hole systems. So these are the sources that emit gravitational waves right at LIGO's peak sensitivity of 100 hertz. Depending on the mass of the binary system, that will decide the frequency, exact frequency content of the signal, where it falls in our band of sensitivity, and what kind of constraints we can place on those objects. So far, all of the action for LIGO has been done in the binary black hole section. But we hope as we increase our sensitivity, we probe a larger space-time volume, that we'll get to these sources that have overall lower amplitudes, so black hole neutron stars and binary neutron stars. And where things get really exciting there is having matter around to produce electromagnetic radiation, so working with electromagnetic partners to really go for multi-messenger astronomy.
So it looks like you put matter around your binary black hole there. Is
that
right?
So down here in the simulation, yeah, there's some matter around there. In practice, we don't think there's going to be much matter around by the time these binary black holes merge.
Is that an artist's impression? That looks like artist's impression.
Yeah, that's an artist's impression. That's right. So they like to keep some matter around. Otherwise, it's just black on black. And...
yes.
So binary black hole systems, they are a compact binary system that have an orbital separation small enough to merge within a Hubble time. So basically, gravitational radiation is driving the in-spiral of these two objects. And we just catch the last few milliseconds to minutes of this in-spiral to the point where they collide and form one final black hole. So this is a numerical relativity simulation where this is basically calculated on a big supercomputer. It takes lots of time. You're familiar here with numerical relativity simulations. Down here is the gravitational wave that we detect far away from the source. And so the main characteristics are this kind of starting off at low amplitude and low frequency, and slowly progressing to higher frequencies and higher amplitudes as this binary in-spirals until the point where the two event horizons get close enough. They plunge together. They form one final black hole system right here at this peak amplitude. And then we have, I'll wait for them to merge to say the rest. Notice the time is very slowed down here. This is a simulation of a GW150914-like system. So this is consistent with the gravitational wave detected first by LIGO. And so here we have the two black holes forming one combined horizon, and then this ring down of the final black hole, the kind of oscillation of these quasi-normal modes as they dampen to produce a steady state black hole solution. So this chirp-like signal is the characteristic signature of a compact binary merger, whether it be in the binary black hole regime or the binary neutron star regime. The dominant characteristics, that increasing in amplitude and frequency, are characteristic of just two point masses falling into one another. Where matter comes into play, where neutron stars are involved, are tidal interactions. Those only come into play at the very last few cycles of in-spiral. And so they only cause subtle deviations that are actually going to be hard to detect. But if we can obviously do very, very exciting science with measuring those tidal parameters and putting constraints on equation of state. So another way to show that waveform is in the spectrogram here. So we have time on the x-axis, frequency on the y-axis, and this is the same kind of characteristics that I just described. You have this kind of slow ramping up in frequency and amplitude as it gets darker, and this is the kind of footprint that we are looking for in LIGO's noise. So to go about doing this, we're really looking for a needle in a haystack at multiple observatories, and we need a good solid model for what the gravitational wave looks like in order to pull it out from the noise. So we use matched filtering in order to do that. So this figure here is showing each dot corresponds to one of those gravitational waves that I just showed you on the previous slide, where the dot in location, so on the x-axis is the mass of the most massive object, and on the y-axis is the mass of the secondary object. Each dot is a template that we collect together into a template bank that we then comb through the data from each of the detectors to pull out interesting signals and interesting points in time to look at the data more closely. Up here, that circle around that dot, that's the template that picked up GW150914 up in the top corner. So when we look for a signal like GW150914 in the data, we look at each detector's data separately with its own template bank. We pull out these triggers, we call them, where we have a high SNR, a high overlap with one of the model signals. and we look for coincidence between the two detectors. So both in time, we expect the delay in arrival of the gravitational wave to be less than 10 milliseconds for the two LIGO detectors, the light travel time between the two detectors. And we obviously expect them to match with the same template, have the same masses as the between the two detectors. So I didn't say it before, but please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point, ask any questions you might have along the way. Yes?
Have you guys updated the sparseness up in the top corner post?
So the sparseness is actually a property of the templates. So basically, as you get to that corner of the parameter space, as you turn the knob on masses, you have less of a detectable difference in the gravitational wave. So this is purely driven. If the way that we construct these template banks is if we construct this template bank in a kind of stochastic way, and we stop once we've hit the point where if you pick a random point on this figure, then if you evaluate the overlap with the nearest template in your bank, you have a 97% overlap. So that is so as far as the sparseness goes, that's what drives our density. And then where it cuts off, you may be a little nervous how close to the edge of that bin the signal fell. And that is due basically to our sensitivity and where the gravitational wave falls in our band. So as you go to high masses, then you push the merger to lower frequencies. And we see less and less of the in-spiral and just the merger and ring down part of the gravitational wave. So once we get up to this high of masses, we basically just catch a merger and ring down. And that looks so much like a generic sine Gaussian kind of burst in gravitational waves that our unmodeled searches are just as accurate and just as able to pull out signals from the data as our unmodeled searches. So at this point, we let the unmodeled searches take over and find those signals. And you had a question?
Matt has stole my question.
So. All right, great. Yes?
So, do I understand you correctly that only the pair of masses are relevant to the profile of the curve?
That only the, sorry, what masses?
The masses of the two objects, the other parameters.
So there's 15 overall parameters that actually go into defining exactly what the gravitational wave looks like at each of the detectors. And so I'll go into a little bit more detail on that. But as far as intrinsic interesting parameters for me are masses and also the spins of the black holes. So both of the magnitude of the spin, how quickly it's rotating, and the orientation of that spin with respect to the orbital angular momentum.
So each point here then has a 13-parameter frequency?
So each point here, so we actually separate the search from the characterization. So the search is really looking for just maximizing over each little chunk of time and trying to pull out any kind of interesting signal. And don't worry about constraining the parameters at all. And so the way that the search actually is conducted is we only have a spin-aligned search right now. So we assume the spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. The spin magnitudes here change, the range that we cover change with the different colors, the different bins here. And the reason behind that is you have down here a neutron star range. We don't expect neutron stars to have extremal spin of one. So we limit the spin in that corner of parameter space. Here is kind of neutron star black hole territory, so the spins are a little bit different there as well. And then the blue bin is kind of the generic overall binary black hole section. And so spins go up pretty extremal there. So we cover masses, spins, and then kind of maximize over all the other nuisance parameters. Yes?
What if the spins are not aligned?
So if the spins are not aligned, it depends a little bit on the actual characteristics of the signal that we detect. So because of our antenna patterns, the antenna pattern for the LIGO detectors is basically this peanut shape. We're most sensitive above and below the detectors. And the gravitational wave emission from a binary is strongest down the orbital angular momentum vector. And because of those two things, we basically expect most sources we detect to be kind of face on and above and below the detectors at the time of the detection. So if the main characteristic of misaligned spins is that it ends up causing precession. So we get wobbling of the orbital plane. And because the amplitude of the emission varies from being when you look face on down the binary versus edge on, you get this overall amplitude modulation. You get a modulation envelope on the signal. It turns out that most of the signals we detect, which are going to be preferentially face on, have low precession. And so a spin aligned search is actually OK and recovers most signals. There are, if we have some wildly oscillating precessing signals in the data, our search may miss some of those low SNR signals. So we can have a more accurate search, but it's really hard to cover the full parameter space at this point.
Also, a measurement shows that they're not aligned.
So when we actually go about characterizing the binary, we account for all of the degrees of freedom that we can. So even though a spin-aligned search isn't the optimal search, it will catch lots and lots of things where spins aren't aligned, just not recover all of the SNR. And so when we go about characterizing, that's when we really, and we allow for unaligned spins, and we put constraints on how misaligned those spins can be. And so I'll go into some of the details on that later. All right. So this is the figure from the first discovery paper, GW150914. And I show it just because it kind of makes all of the stuff I said not true. We didn't need match filtering to pull this signal out of the data. This is a minimally enhanced chunk of data around the time of the event. And you don't need a special gravitational wave model to convince yourself that there's a signal in the data. So the way that we produce this data here is we take our raw strain recorded by the detectors. We do an overall bandpass filter. So we basically throw out everything below 35 hertz and above 350 hertz. So we just show that band between 35 and 350 hertz. And then we have notch filters at known locations of spectral lines in the data. So that's like the 60 hertz line for the power oscillation, known locations for calibration lines and some other things, pendulum modes and things in the mirror suspensions. And just with that minimal filtering, this is what comes out. So you get this beautiful looking signal on top of rather Gaussian and stationary noise. And if you look on the right here, so the data on the left is Hanford, on the right is Livingston, and then the faint red that's overlaid on top of the Livingston detector data is the Hanford data shifted 7 milliseconds in time and with a sine flip to account for the 90 degree rotation of the relative orientation of the instruments. And the two signals overlay one another exactly. It looks just like we would expect for a nice coincident gravitational wave passing between the detectors. Yes?
Why is it that the 150914 signal looks like a numerical relativity template, whereas the 151226 is very noisy?
So
it looks like an experimental detection.
That's right. So this looks too good to be true. GW151226 looked like we expected. There's a few reasons for that. One of them was that nature was incredibly kind to us and gave us a very high signal-to-noise ratio signal. That was our expectation as well. So that's why we have really the full matched filtering and kind of robust way to go about characterizing significance of events. We didn't expect it to be this easy. We actually spent a lot of time and resources in looking into malicious injections of signals because it looked too good to be true. And so I can go into some details on that later. But we basically did everything we could to rule out simulations of signals being injected maliciously in the data. And the confirmation is really in the extra detections in GW151226, in the non-significant, the kind of borderline significant LVT151012 that we don't confidently call a gravitational wave. Everything is looking like a very consistent picture with a nice high, kind of according to expectations, binary black hole merger rate. But so far, everything is looking consistent. But this made us all a little nervous because it was almost too good to be true.
Right.
So there's a few things that make this really stand out and look like a numerical relativity signal in our data. One of them is just how lucky we are with a high signal to noise ratio. The other is the kind of mass range that it lies in. So this was a high mass event, meaning that we only caught the last few cycles of the in-spiral and then the merger and ring down. And so when we actually pull out the SNR, what we call the SNR, the matched filter SNR, most of it is concentrated just in the merger part. And so it's a very kind of short duration, high signal to noise ratio signal that stands out from the noise in this case. And I'll show a comparable figure for GW151226 to kind of show the differences. So that's the data on top. The next row down are the constraints on that signal from our various searches. So they're hard to see on the screen, but there's a light gray, a dark gray, and then a colored red and blue signal all overlaid on one another. So the light and dark gray are the 90% bounds on the signal in the two detectors. And the difference between them is assuming that it was a compact binary merger as described by general relativity that arrived at both detectors. And so that's the really kind of strong a priori statement that we believe a gravitational wave from a compact binary merger as described by general relativity hit our detectors. The light gray, which is only slightly fatter, is the unmodeled constraint on the signal. So instead of assuming it was a compact binary signal with a specific morphology, it just looked for coherent power across the network. And because this was such a high signal to noise ratio, just the demand for coherence, basically you can recover most of the signal that's in the data. And so it's actually not that much less sensitive than our completely modeled search. And this is kind of just showing you kind of an illustration of, if we go to even higher masses, why these two searches are getting pretty comparable in terms of sensitivity.
Sorry, can you define what you mean by coherent signal across the network? What does that mean?
So the way that we actually model it is you assume the gravitational wave is a sine Gaussian signal incident on Earth from some particular location in the sky. And you account for the projection onto the two detectors from the antenna pattern, the relative polarization angles, and then you get what the signal looks like in the two detectors.
Gaussian,
yeah, so just like a sinusoidal wave damped by a Gaussian.
Okay.
And so the way the unmodeled searches go about doing this search is they just assume the signal is some arbitrary kind of composition of a bunch of different sine Gaussians with different properties to kind of, you can think of it as reconstructing a generic shape in that time frequency figure I showed you before. So instead of assuming it's this chirp track, just look for coherent power in time frequency space across the network.
How many sine Gaussians do you need to get this?
Around 7. And so the next row down, that is now we take the best fit signal from our compact binary search, we subtract it from the data, we get the residuals out, and the way that we show this figure, this was a battle that I actually fought long and hard and lost. I don't like the way we actually show this in the end. So this is now showing you what the residuals look like with that bandpass plus notch filtering. Another way we could go about it is to show the data like we actually analyze it. And so instead of using that bandpass plus notch filtering, we can take our estimate for the power spectral density of the noise, use that to whiten the data so that now the data that we show, and specifically the residuals, are just draws from a unit normal distribution. That would have a kind of robust, statistically meaningful statement in this last row, but it doesn't. So just say that that looks kind of like noise, and we believe that the signal matches well.
But isn't that widened? I thought that
the... No, this is actually, these are the residuals with the bandpass plus notch filtering. So it's not actually whitened.
But and the top one, wasn't that?
That wasn't whitened either. That was just this bandpass plus notch filtering.
Okay.
So I'll show the figure that I produced for the GW150914 parameter estimation paper where we go about characterizing the signal, and that, because I had a little bit more say in the figure, ended up being whitening. So in the end, they look very similar.
Okay.
It's just the statistical meaning of these residuals changes subtly between the two. And then finally down here is the kind of time frequency content of the signal, and just showing that we get this nice chirp track. Here, we didn't need all of our fancy data analysis tools. A monkey with headphones at the two detectors probably could have pulled this one out of the noise. All right, so then, as we mentioned before, there's quite a bit of difference between the first detection, GW150914, and the second gravitational wave detection, GW151226. So the figure here is similar in makeup, but a little bit different in how we show our confidence in the signal. So here, we've got the data in red and blue. There's no obvious gravitational wave signal in there if you look at it by eye. We've overlaid our constraint on the signal there, so that's assuming it was a compact binary merger, overlaying the constraint on the signal buried in the noise. So we're basically just saying that at no point is the amplitude of the gravitational wave sticking above the amplitude of the noise. We really need this kind of matched filter approach to pull out the whole coherent signal across the frequency band. The next row down is showing you how we accumulate SNR in our time series template. So we've got that nice chirp waveform that I showed you in the time domain before, overlaid here with the data, and now as we integrate over the data, we collect the SNR as we go from early to late times, and this shows you how the SNR is accumulated, and basically pick up a lot of SNR toward the end as we get towards merger because of the high amplitude. And it's basically the same picture in both detectors. And the next row down now shows you the SNR time series, we call it. So now it's taking that template waveform and combing through the data with it, much like we do with our templated searches. And so as you go at earlier times, overlaying that template that best matches the signal, you don't recover much SNR until you get it right overlaid with where the signal actually is, and you get these spikes in SNR, which show you the time of arrival of the gravitational wave at the two detectors. And then finally, this is the time frequency spectrogram of the data, and there is a obvious chirp track in Hanford because I'm going to overlay the pointer on it. So right there is the gravitational wave in the data. But it's nowhere near as obvious as GW150914, obviously. And over in Livingston, you really only see the amplitude kind of stick out from the noise at merger. And so this is a case where we really needed our full framework to go about searching for and characterizing and quantifying the significance of this gravitational wave event. So this is much closer to what we expected our first gravitational wave detection to look like. We got incredibly lucky that we could just show the data and have a press release and a press conference where we just play sounds of the gravitational wave strain and can convince people meaningfully that there was a gravitational wave in there. We expected it to be like this and for people to be like, don't really believe you, but build up kind of that the significance over time as we detect more and more signals. So we got really lucky, but everything is consistent because we are detecting these lower SNR but still very significant signals in the data as we go along. So this is, yes?
Why is it that the chirp signal, the gravitational wave hits Livingston first.
Hits Livingston first.
The search signal is audible, search signal is not obvious.
So the arrival time at the two instruments is completely dependent on where in the sky the signal is coming from. So for GW151226, this was much more consistent with that picture that I painted before of having most signals be kind of overhead. And so for GW151226, the arrival time is very, very close at the two instruments. It's basically consistent with being over or under the United States while at the time the signal hit Earth. With GW150914, the arrival time is delayed by 7 milliseconds. And so that is the reason for that. We had to do that time delay to slide and overlay them to look like one another. And that was just by chance that happened to be actually off the peak of the antenna pattern and a bit to the side. So that is actually most of the probabilities concentrated in the southern hemisphere. And if you overlay it with the sky at the time of the arrival, it was actually kind of lying over the Large Magellanic Cloud. Just by coincidence, it was obviously much further away than the Magellanic Clouds. But so the delay in time of arrival has everything to do with the location on the sky, and that decides basically how quickly they arrive at the two detectors. Okay, so this is the kind of summary figure that I prepared for the 01 BBH paper that just kind of compares all of the gravitational waves from binary black holes detected during LIGO's first observing run. So on the left is showing you the frequency domain representation of all of these signals, and on the right is showing you the time series. GW150914 is up here at top, and GW151226 is down here at the bottom. And each of these start at when the gravitational wave passed through 30 hertz. So that's about when it starts becoming detectable within LIGO's band. So as I said before, GW150914 had a very short duration in band in our sensitivity band for the detectors, whereas GW151226 spent quite a bit of time actually within band where we could actually detect the signal in the data. And then the gravitational wave that could be LVT151012 with an SNR not loud enough for us to claim it as a gold-plated gravitational wave detection, that we assign an 87% probability that it was astrophysical versus a terrestrial noise source. And so that we don't claim as a GW, but we think that it's probably a gravitational wave. That lies in the middle. And so the way that this falls in band, the duration that the signal spends in band, is largely representative of the masses of the binary. And so over here, that's kind of represented with how much of that in spiral is actually within our band of sensitivity, which is these power spectral density right here, kind of defining the bucket that we're sensitive in. And so this is just kind of a hint at what the interesting properties are of the binaries, the masses, and specifically that GW150914 was very massive, and GW151226 a little bit less so. But I'll go into the details of how we really put solid constraints on that with uncertainties in the coming slides. All right, so that's how we go about detecting these signals. But where does astrophysics come in? LIGO's finally earned its O. It's an observatory. We're detecting astrophysical things. And we want to extract interesting science out of these detections. And so one of the very exciting goals of LIGO, in my mind, is to be able to separate out formation channels and figure out how these compact binaries are being formed. So far, our knowledge of black hole formation, stellar mass black hole formation, largely comes from X-ray binaries. And so we're relying on systems like this, where you have a black hole with a stellar companion that's losing mass to the black hole, forming an accretion disk. You're getting radiation from this accretion disk and X-rays, and we use that X-ray emission to try to learn as much about the black hole as possible. So we can get pretty accurate mass estimates from that. We can potentially get spin measurements from that, figure out how rapidly rotating that black hole is. It's a bit complicated how we go about doing that. So it assumes basically that you assume the inner edge of the accretion disk is at the innermost stable circular orbit and the matter plunges in. So that's kind of defining the inner edge of your accretion disk. And then you do a whole bunch of complicated modeling of the emission mechanisms in the accretion disk, ray tracing, general relativistic ray tracing around the black holes, to try to model completely the X-ray component of the emission and use that to try to back out the measurement of the spin. And so that has a lot of systematics involved with it that are difficult to quantify. And so the uncertainties on those spin measurements need to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. On the LIGO side, things are different. So there, we don't have any matter involved. We're just measuring the properties of these very, very simplistic objects. They're defined by only their mass and spin, and then the relative components of the binary, so the orientation of those two things with respect to one another, just under the mechanisms of general relativity. There's very few systematics at play, just the systematics involved with producing our approximate models that we use to do this characterization. And so I would argue that the error bars are much more meaningful on the constraints we place on spins with LIGO and gravitational wave detections than with X-ray binaries that we've done in the past. So the way we've learned about these is about to change completely. We've now gotten real gravitational wave detections. We can start putting really interesting constraints on these properties. And we can start to separate ways they're formed. So two leading channels we think that form compact binaries like the ones LIGO is detecting are what we call field or cluster formation. So in the field formation scenario, you have a binary that's formed in situ somewhere in a galaxy. There's a large separation between this binary and the next nearest stellar object. So you have just these two stars that are evolving completely independently of one another in a gravitationally bound orbit, overgoing their normal kind of stellar evolution. As they run out of hydrogen, they're going to inflate, they're going to hit dwarf phases, they're going to start shedding mass and losing it to the companion object. There's lots of physics that goes into modeling that. But over the course of that evolution, we think there's often phases like common envelope phase, where one star is basically orbiting within the envelope of the other star. And that can do things to harden the binary, to make it get much more closer together, to the point where once they form compact objects, gravitational radiation will take over and make them in spiral. So we think that that's one channel of formation these binaries may be undergoing. A complementary approach is through cluster formation. So this is in dense stellar environments like globular clusters. There, these compact objects are so close together that they interact with one another all the time. So they can form binaries. They can have three-body interactions that form gravitationally bound binaries. You have scattering interactions. So here is a kind of representation of these two channels. So first, the cluster one. So there's lots of different interactions that can happen in this dense stellar environment. You have three-body formation, as I just said, of a binary, constant bombardment by other compact objects passing nearby that can act to harden that binary, exchange interactions that can produce an even more closely orbiting binary, all the way until the point of producing things like GW150914. And then the field approach here, as I said, is kind of evolving two stars from the main sequence through their binary interactions. And so the imprint of these formation channels on the parameters of the systems that we detect is how we can eventually hope to separate these two channels and other competing channels in the literature. One of the most compelling arguments for being able to separate these things is spin. So with this field formation, especially going through things like common envelope phase, we expect the spins of these objects to be aligned relative to the orbital angular momentum. With cluster interaction with this dense stellar environment, you have all of these three-body interactions and dynamics at play that basically produce, in the end, isotropically distributed spin distributions. So with LIGO, once we detect more and more of these binary black hole systems and put constraints on these spins and specifically their orientations, we can really start to separate out these populations, we hope. But so far, the gravitational waves we've detected, because spin is so hard to measure, we don't have any meaningful constraints, so we can't rule out one formation channel from the other yet. So the way that we go about doing this is something I keep alluding to. It's this parameter estimation step. It's this characterization of the binaries that we detect with LIGO. The tool that we do that is one that I worked on as part of my PhD, LAL Inference. And the goal of this algorithm, basically, is to, we have two triggers from the searches that I just mentioned before, this mass filtering search. That identifies the time in the data where there's likely a gravitational wave. This code is what we use to then go and robustly characterize that signal. So now that we know there's a gravitational wave in the data, we really work to constrain all of these parameters, masses and spins, sky location, distance to the source, and do those all in a self-consistent way. So accounting for degeneracies in the signal, which is really important, especially between spin and mass ratio. And then we can put these error bars on the constraint, on the interesting parameters that we want to do astrophysics with. And so the way we go about doing that is with Bayesian inference. So here is kind of the standard Bayes theorem slide. Theta here is containing all the parameters in our model, so the masses and the spins, along with sky position, inclination, et cetera. So this is encapsulating the prior, which is all of our previous knowledge of the source. So we try to go with uninformative priors there, which is a rather hard thing to define. So things like sky position, we can say fairly certainly that we don't expect any preferential location for gravitational waves in the local universe. We think that they're basically distributed on this scale uniformly in the local universe. Things that are more complicated for priors are things like masses. We don't know the underlying astrophysical distribution of masses of compact binaries. That's something we actually hope to infer from the data. And so there we use uniform and component masses just as a choice, and that does influence our answers to some degree. And then over here, the likelihood is where the data comes in. And so this is now where we take our models for what these waveforms look like, given a certain value of masses and spins, and we ask how consistent the data are with that given guess of what the binary looks like. And so in practice, what that means is we generate our model waveforms for the network, given some value for masses, sky location, spin. We subtract that model signal from the data, and we measure statistically how consistent the residuals are with the Gaussian noise. And so that's our likelihood function. And those combine to give us our posterior function here. And this is really the product of the LIGO parameter estimation effort. So this is a 15-dimensional probability density function that defines our complete characterization of this source. So it's really encapsulating all of the uncertainty, and it's extracting all the information that the data are providing us on the information for each of these binaries. And so these are the 15 parameters that I mentioned before. Intrinsic to the source are the masses and spins of those two compact objects, and then the things that affect how that intrinsic gravitational wave is projected across the network are things like sky location, distance, the angle of the how face-on the binary is, the relative orientation of the binary on the sky, and then the relative merger time when it arrives at Earth. And so from that, we get this nice 15-dimensional probability density function, and we can marginalize over the parameters we're not interested in. So we can, when we estimate things like masses, account for our uncertainties in spins, and that's what we do here. So this is a figure that I produced for the O1 BBH summary paper, and it's showing you the constraints on the component masses for all the binaries we've detected so far. So this is the source of the mass of the most massive object in the binary on the x-axis and the less massive object on the y-axis. And these are showing you the 50 and 90% credible regions for each of the signals we've detected so far. So GW150914 is up here at high masses. GW151226 is down here at low masses. Yes?
So why did you decide to go with 50 and 90% and everybody else has 68 and 95%?
So LIGO is a big collaboration. Funny things happen when you collaboratively write a paper with 1,000 people. So you have to pick your battles.
I see. Okay.
And so part of it is once you get to...
The contours get smaller if you do that.
Yeah, so the size of the contours here is only partly the case. So constraining these things to the level of 99% gets to be very expensive. So we do have 99% credible bounds, but to generate enough samples to have high confidence in exactly the location of those bounds takes a long time. So there's a few reasons that go into there, and then also the just speaking to the width of these bounds for a minute is this is actually a bit broader of a picture than if you look at really what kind of comes out of the analysis. So if we were to draw these contours just on the samples that come from the analysis, those are the what we would call the detector masses. So that's that includes a redshifting of the signal. And so we can put very tight bounds on the redshifted masses. The breadth of these posterior distributions folds into account our uncertainty in distance and kind of undoing that redshifting. But so I don't have a very satisfying answer for you there. But was there another question here? All right. So this is the picture that we have so far. And you'll notice this kind of characteristic banana shape. So this banana shape is these lines that these contours are following are lines of constant chirp mass. And so that's a special combination of masses that enters at low order the post-Newtonian expansion of these binaries of the gravitational waves. That we constrain very, very well. And so it just has this arbitrary kind of banana-like shape in component mass space. And that is what decides basically the kind of width of the banana. And the extent of the banana is the mass ratio. And that's something we have a difficult time constraining. So the extent of how far the banana goes out is partly due to our inability to measure mass ratio, but it's also our inability to measure spin. So there's a very, very strong degeneracy between the mass ratio of the binary and the magnitude of the spin that's aligned with the orbital angular momentum. So basically, as we account for spin, as we account for our uncertainty in spin, it really broadens this mass ratio here, and that's a good illustration of why we really need to do this kind of big machinery, 15-dimensional parameter estimation. We need to account for all the uncertainties in the signals that we measure. So first, I'll talk a little bit about the interesting astrophysical implications of these individual signals that we've detected so far. And then I'll go into kind of the future and where I think this is going to go as we go into this, as we finish the second observing round of the LIGO detectors and go into the future. So GW150914, the first detection, a loud one, we constrain the masses very tightly. And one of the most surprising aspects of GW150914, besides just how loud and lucky we were to measure it, was the masses of these objects. So each of those masses are in the 30s of solar masses. So 29 on 36 are kind of the median estimates of the binary masses. And those are very massive. They're more massive than the X-ray binary black holes that we've detected so far. And so that has implications, some implications on the environment that these black holes were formed in. So as far as the channels that I showed before, the field versus cluster formation, both of those channels can produce black holes with this mass. What it's difficult to do is keep stars that are massive enough have that much matter by the time they form the black hole. And so this has some constraints on winds, for example. So these had to have been very massive stars at main sequence at, when they were born. And they must have had low winds because we think that any appreciable wind, they would have shed too much mass by the time they formed the black hole to have masses like 29 and 36 solar masses. So that starts to place constraints on both the wind model, the wind mechanism itself, and also the metallicity of these stars. We think that they must have had much, much lower metallicity than our sun in order to maintain enough mass by the time they form black holes to produce a binary like GW150914. As I said before, though, masses are going to be hard to kind of distinguish these two formation channels between field and cluster. But spins are a very promising channel, a way to extract the information on these formation channels. And so this is a representation of the constraints that we placed on spin for all of the black holes detected by LIGO so far. So on the top row are the primary black holes, so the most massive black holes in the binary. On the bottom row are the secondary black holes. GW150914 is over here on the left, GW151226 over here on the right. And these clouds here are showing the three-dimensional probability distribution for the location of the spin vector of each of the black holes. And so these areas with high color are showing where there's a high probability density. And then the lacking color down here, for example, is low probability. So we can rule out the spin vector being down in this part here. And these are oriented, so they're three-dimensional. They're oriented so that the orbital angular momentum is facing up right now. And then I'll just rotate them so you can kind of see the 3D properties of these constraints. And so the azimuthal orientation of these spins, we don't think encapsulates much interesting physically. But the relative misalignment with the orbital angular momentum is where a lot of the information is that we want to extract. And so what we show in the GW150914 characterization paper, as well as the O1 BBH paper, are these kind of spin disk plots that I created to kind of highlight where the data is actually being informative. So these are 2D histograms. On the left is showing you the information on the primary spin. On the right is showing you the information for the secondary spin. The bins are variable width, and we've done that to basically give equal prior weight to each of these bins. So if the data were not informing us on spins whatsoever, this would just be a uniform colored plot. Any overdensity in color here is the data actually informing us on where these spins may be. So for the primary spin for GW150914 and the secondary spin, we constrain both of them to not be extreme and aligned. So up here, so the radial direction is the spin magnitude, and the arc is the misalignment with respect to the orbital angular momentum. So in the scenario where if you think these black holes are spinning at the maximum allowed by general relativity, a spin of 1, and that they're perfectly aligned with the orbital angular momentum, that would put you up in this corner of the plot here. And we've actually ruled that out with pretty high certainty. So already we're starting to get information, interesting information on the orientation and magnitudes of these spins. But you'll notice that we don't constrain them very well. So just from a single event, it's hard to actually put any meaningful constraints on formation channels. Yes?
So this kind of gets at my question. But if you were to treat the spin parameters, those 6 parameters, as a model selection problem,
yes,
and compute the evidence ratio with and without, I mean, how does it fare? Is there really evidence for spin?
So how you go about doing that is a bit uncertain. So you'd have to give prior odds for that kind of a model selection problem, right? So you'd have to kind of say whether you think these things are actually spin aligned or not. And that's a hard prior to put. I mean, personally, I think that...
If I just compute the evidence ratio directly.
Okay, just the base factor then.
Yeah.
So right now, nothing is definitive, no. So it's pretty uniform.
But that depends on the prior.
It's on prior for the spins. That's right. Yeah.
And the prior odds. So what you're saying is basically assume there's equal probability of it being perfectly aligned and isotropic.
That's right.
Yeah. So right now, it's not very definitive.
So you say you cannot say much about the channel formation. Let's say you keep seeing something just consistent with this.
Yeah.
Are you not, once you add a little bit of astrophysics knowledge into it, would you begin to say, well, something's going on with the PM model, the common embedded support is high
mass? Yeah, so far with the 2.9 detections we've made so far, we can't say very much that's interesting, but I'll show you exactly how that changes with the number of events in a few slides. Yes?
So in your papers, you could have result measurement of chi effect.
Yes.
The inner product of the two vectors.
Right.
0.26 plus or minus some small number. It's a very definite statement.
Yeah, so this for GW150914, the constraint on chi effective is consistent with zero. So the probability distribution of chi effective is overlapping with zero. For GW151226, it excludes zero. And so I'll show what that kind of means in component spins just for people that aren't familiar with chi effective. But yeah, so we put interesting constraints on chi effective. That's the thing that we can measure most sensitively so far. And yeah, so that's a very interesting and important parameter to constrain. So yeah, as you can see right here, well, it's either they are high spin magnitudes that are not aligned with the orbital angular momentum, or if they are aligned, then it must be a small spin magnitude, which is basically a rephrasing of the distribution here. That's right. So it could be. So from GW150914, the first thing we can say definitively is that not all black holes have spins that are extreme and aligned or anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. For LVT151012, it's a rather similar picture. So we have a less meaningful constraint on the secondary spin, just because the mass ratio can be more extreme and the secondary object has less momentum overall to throw around the gravitational wave signal. For the primary spin, it's kind of the same picture. We rule out extreme and aligned. If it's in the plane, we have less constraint on the spin magnitude. Basically the same kind of picture that we constrain the effective spin to be kind of a rather peak distribution near zero. And then GW151226 so far is the most interesting in terms of its constraints on the spin. So here, this is the lowest mass binary we've detected so far. We see the most of the in spiral of any gravitational wave we've detected so far. And so we can put the best constraints on the properties that affect the in spiral, so specifically the spins. And so for the primary object, for the very first time, we could constrain meaningfully the spin being above zero. And so even when you fold in to get all together this six-dimensional probability density function, we can say with 100% certainty that at least one black hole in that binary had non-zero spin. So for the first time, we can say definitively we've measured a spinning black hole. And for GW151226, we can actually put a pretty interesting bound on the misalignment of that spin of the primary object. So we rule out the anti-aligned scenario in this case, and we place all the probability in the aligned direction, but with some more probability actually for misalignment than alignment. But we still can't rule out very definitively aligned spins. So things are starting to get interesting. It's hard to measure spins for these objects. And so where the things really, really get interesting is with looking at these as a whole and trying to incorporate all of the information we're getting from the entire population that the LIGO instruments are detecting as we detect them. So here's a quick summary of what I think are the interesting lessons from the first observing run. So we've got two confident binary black hole detections with a third likely detection. So far painting a very complete and self-consistent picture of there being a high but totally consistent with theory merger rate of binary black hole systems in the local universe. We know that massive stellar mass black holes exist above 30 solar masses. And so that's starting to put some interesting information on the types of metallicities and the types of stellar winds that are involved with producing these binaries. We know that not all black holes have extreme spin that's aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And we know that not all black holes have no spin. And that so far, everything is consistent with GR as best as we can constrain it. And there are going to be many, 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 many more black holes, binary black hole systems in LIGO's future. So now looking to the future, answering Luis's question of when we have many events, how many events do we need to actually start really measuring these formation channels in a meaningful way? And that's kind of where I've been working on most recently, so in looking at population inference. So now we have these 2.9 detections. We have presumably more detections coming in O2 and many more detections in future observing runs. We want to now get at what we used to call the prior, what that underlying astrophysical distribution is of interesting source properties like masses and spins. And so what we want to do is actually apply the same Bayesian framework that we used before, but in a hierarchical way. And doing that, we want to come up with a parameterized model for the underlying population, start putting constraints on it, and comparing those to what theory expects for the various distributions of these things depending on formation channels. So one way you can go about doing that, if you want to take the kind of physics agnostic approach, is to just create a very simplistic underlying distribution, model for your underlying distribution, and a histogram. So for masses, for example, here, we have M1 and M2 for the primary and secondary masses. We can just model the population as this binned histogram, where each parameter in our now population model is just the height of these bins. And then we can tie them together with some kind of regularization. And in the case of this, we use a Gaussian process regularization. So we just demand some typical length scale for smoothness of the overall mass function underlying this thing. And so that we use this underlying regularization. There's some extra hyperparameters that go into that, basically the kind of length scale for the Gaussian process for the smoothness. And then the other parameters are just the heights of all of the bins in our underlying population model. And now we can replace the prior that I showed you in that kind of simplistic Bayesian inference slide with now another step in the Bayesian inference. So instead of saying that we have some uninformative prior, we think the masses are distributed uniformly in component mass, we now put a model in there, which is our population model. And that's something we want to constrain. And now we integrate that over all the detected signals by LIGO. And we basically fold into account all of the information the data provide us. So those complicated bananas in mass space and broad constraints on spin magnitudes, we fold in all of that information for each event and then use that to inform these population models and try to put constraints on what the underlying mass function and spin functions look like for the population of binaries that LIGO is detecting. So here's kind of an illustration of how powerful this method can be.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So, I mean, of course, you have more and more quote-unquote events with lower signal-to-noise ratio. And of the lower signal-to-noise, the more likely, the less likely it is that it's real, right?
Yep.
So the question is, where do you want to cut it off? And,
so this method can actually fold into account also our confidence in each signal.
Yeah.
So you can basically put them in with a relative weight that is your confidence in them being a real signal. So something like the LVT 15, 10, 12, we can downweight that based on our assessment of how likely it's astrophysical. And so we can model basically, you can think of it as modeling the noise and the signal at the same time as we infer the population. So we can either take a drastic approach of just having some conservative cutoff and throwing out everything that doesn't look.
But the question is, which button should you do? And I guess you get different answers.
So the most important thing, we actually get consistent answers as long as you account for the selection effects when you construct your prior for the population inference.
Yeah.
So we need to fold into account how likely we are to detect a signal if it exists in each part of the mass space if we want to measure the underlying mass population. So really, the important thing is assessing selection effects. And because we have robust models for what the signals look like, and we have the full framework and real noise to simulate, we can basically assess that selective function pretty accurately. So it's not very sensitive to...
it's not very sensitive.
It's not very sensitive, yeah. OK, so this is kind of an illustration of how powerful this technique can be. So this is showing the output of a population synthesis simulation, so simulating the output of compact binary population, assuming just field formation. And so we've got down here a binary neutron star set of sources. We have neutron star black hole and binary black hole systems. This gap right here is basically representative of what we see in existing black holes and neutron stars. Observationally speaking, we see there seems to be a gap, a drop in the number of signals. We don't see any sources in between basically the upper mass bound for a neutron star and the lowest mass black hole, so basically between 3 and 5 solar masses, there seems to be a void of objects. And so you can produce that with population synthesis, and this is the case. But here it's used as just an illustration of there being some sharp feature in the underlying function, and we want to know how quickly, with LIGO detections, do we see evidence that there is this lack of sources here, or this lack of sources kind of here in this medium mass ratio binary black hole regime. So here is showing you that histogram that I showed before. It's showing you the median estimate on it as the number of events increases in LIGO. So I'll start the slide over again from the beginning. But the height of each bin is a parameter, and what we're showing here is just the median value for that bin for each of these numbers of detections. So here, starting off at 10, you see that there's an overdensity of sources kind of here. And only after 10, 30, 40 detections, you already start to see evidence of this mass gap and a lack of signals kind of over here in the medium mass ratio regime. Yes?
It's a really naive question. How can you come you constrain more bins than you have numbers of sources?
So it has a lot to do with both the selection function and the and that kind of smoothness, the demand for smoothness with the Gaussian process regularization.
So it's all prior until you get a number of sources that's equal to the number of bins.
So it has to do, well, sorry, say that again?
It's all prior, it's all input information until the number of sources matches the number of bins.
Right, so it's largely, you can think of it as being kind of driven by your prior. And whether or not you think that assumption that the function is smooth or not is a good one. But in terms of selection effects, there's a very strong effect of selection here because we know that we detect binary neutron star systems to a much less distance than the binary black hole systems. We see those much further away. And so we know that it takes a while to get kind of information on the event rate for neutron star systems, and that affects how quickly you can constrain things down here. But the broad level of kind of constraint you're seeing is at early times driven by the prior.
So this statement about Gaussian smoothness, you're assuming a covariance between bins. What does that mean exactly?
There's a covariance between bins and the kernel that we use, so basically, the kernel that goes into that covariance is partly chosen through art and partly chosen through information from the data. But basically, you just use a kind of squared exponential kernel, which is basically just saying it's kind of a Gaussian-like distribution of functions. And so that's something that we actually marginalize over our uncertainty in the length scale. But the functional form of it is something we just make a priori, a selection make a priori. So this is the picture from masses. And the important things to take away is that after tens of detections, we already start to get kind of broad level statements about the underlying population. We can say that the mass gap looks like it might actually be there, and it's not just a selection effect of electromagnetic observations, and that there seems to be a void of kind of medium mass ratio binary black hole systems. And then as we get towards 80 events, then we have a strong statement about the presence of a mass gap and other kind of strong imprints on the underlying mass function.
This, of course, statement is based on gravitational waves alone.
Just based on gravitational waves alone, exactly.
Perhaps you could do it with a lot else.
Say that again?
If you have counterparts on the command.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is just assuming our only channel of information is through gravitational waves. And if we have electromagnetic constraints, then we may be able to do things even faster. So that's masses, and now I'll show you a kind of an illustration of how powerful this can be for spins. So as I said, this is what really excites me as a way to kind of start distinguishing formation channels for these binaries. But things are a little bit more messy. We don't put as tight of constraints as I showed you for the component masses on spins. And so here I'm going to simulate an underlying population of binaries whose spins, all of the primary spins are below 0.5, so they're not extremely spinning. And all of their tilts are less than 45 degrees. So all of the orientations, the misalignments of tilts are 45 degrees and less. And so here is just giving you kind of an illustration of the individual constraints on binaries. So these are posterior draws from each of the events that are going into this now population inference. And they don't seem to be animating. Give me one second. There we go. So this is kind of showing you the draws of all of these events. And a few of them in there, here and there, are pretty informative. But for the most part, they look very consistent to what I've been showing you for the actual detections from LIGO so far. And so I'm going to show you now the same exact picture that I showed you for masses, but in constraints on spin. So on the x-axis here is the spin magnitude for the primary object. And on the y-axis is the cosine of that tilt. And so again, all of the sources in my simulation are confined up to this upper corner here. They're kind of low tilt and low spin magnitude. But the constraints on each of them are pretty poor. And so we need to get a bunch of these events to start actually kind of estimating what the underlying population looks like. So this is what the median estimate for that function looks like at three events. And then as we add events, we get surprisingly quick constraints on what the spin magnitude and tilt orientations are. So again, this is just the median estimate. And so there's uncertainties on each of these bins that I'll show in the next slide. Yes?
You're assuming that there is no dependence on the mass. So this is something, no matter the mass of the event, you're just assuming it has the same spin.
That's right. So this is right now just estimating the in this case, two-dimensional function, which is the...
Do something where they actually...
So yeah, the very exciting direction to go is to include all of the interesting physics all at once, and so to do the kind of eight-dimensional distribution of the spins and masses, using this kind of binned regularized histogram approach. There's a ton of parameters to do that model, And so it's rather infeasible at this time to do this kind of approach with that big of a parameter space. And so kind of the future is really to find ways to do this in a more robust way for higher dimensions.
What if you were, for example, take some parameters out, for example, let's say the primary field is not important. So would that make it easier?
So we can take, yeah, we can take parameters out to make it easier. And so that's, for example, why I'm looking at just the primary object and not the secondary object, because for most events, we don't put meaningful constraints on the secondary spin. And as for masses, masses could be potentially very interesting, especially if we want to compare in a meaningful way against population synthesis results, which give you a full mass and spin distribution. So we can be selective in the kinds of parameters that we use and to try to limit the number of dimensions. And so that makes it a little more feasible, but so far we haven't been able to do it. So for right now, all I'm showing is, yeah, like you said, it's just assuming this the same spin distribution across all masses. But we do incorporate uncertainties in our ability to constrain mass in each of the individual events because we marginalize over them individually. Yes?
Did you have a particular astrophysical scenario that you were envisioning to motivate that particular choice of spin distribution?
So that particular choice, you could argue, could be motivated by a kind of field evolution. So you kind of have a preferential alignment of spins. The spin magnitudes that come out of a population synthesis simulation of field evolution can give you a wide variety of estimates for spin magnitudes. So I picked less than 0.5 just to make it kind of a semi-worst case scenario. So when the spins are extreme, you can constrain them pretty easily for a lot of cases, which is how we've actually been able to rule them out fairly confidently for the events we've detected so far. So I just picked it as kind of a generic choice of some easy bounds in spin magnitude and orientation, but not particularly motivated by anything in the field formation theory, besides them being just kind of preferentially aligned.
Have you made assumptions here about the ratio of the masses in the event?
Yeah, so implicitly, yes, there are some assumptions about the masses. And so basically, in the sources that I simulated for to be able to constrain individual spins were uniform in masses between basically 3 and 30 solar masses.
And the ratio was randomized, also uniform.
That's right. Yes?
So it's a bit complicated. It says primary spin magnet. What about the secondary spin?
The secondary, I don't constrain at all in this case. So
if you have zero spin, then of course this could be anything, right? Because
yeah, the constraint on...
Why is there any constraint on zero spin?
So let me show you the next slide here. So this is showing you, just to give you an idea of the uncertainties involved with this. So now I'm showing marginal distributions for the functional form of the spin magnitude on the left and the misalignment on the right over the same number of detections. So starting off at 3 and then increasing as we go. And so your question was how, if your spins are very low, how can you put any constraint on the misalignment?
Yeah.
And so partly it's the width of the bins. So you fold into there, the bins were rather broad, right? So looking back here, it's from 0 to 0.2. So you can measure spin angles at a spin magnitude of 0.2 fairly reasonably for some number of events. But it's also the smoothness constraint, right? Because once we go after a few events, you can definitely put meaningful constraints on these kind of medium spin magnitudes. Mm-hmm. And having that kind of Gaussian process prior means that you could probably build up confidence in the spin just due to prior assumptions.
I would say then your bins are probably too big at this point.
Yes, so the bins are broad, but we also don't expect for a while. Once we get towards 80 or hundreds of events, then maybe we can start dropping the bin size. But in the beginning, when you don't have very many events, to go overboard on the number of bins is kind of a meaningless exercise just because we don't get that much information out of the data. All right, so that is the kind of what I think is the future for these kind of population inferences and being able to put constraints on the functional forms of the underlying population. And that's really going to be how we can tie this to theory and start putting meaningful constraints on physical mechanisms that are leading to the production of these binaries. And so the takeaways from the spin constraint side is that after about tens of events, we can start to see kind of strong features in the underlying distribution. So in this case, I had hard boundaries at high misalignments and high spin magnitudes. And it doesn't take very long to start seeing that those kind of strong features in the underlying population. And in this case, we could rule out isotropic spin distributions that you would expect for cluster binaries, for example, out by around 20 or 30 events. So in general, the prospects for this kind of population constraints in both mass and spin, and hopefully in the future combining them together, is basically the same for the two. So after tens of events, you can start to see these kind of strong features like a mass gap or like a lack of isotropically distributed spins for binaries. And by the time we get to the end of O2 and definitely into O3, we can really start to do very interesting things from the population inference standpoint. And so that's kind of the future, I think, for being able to do meaningful astrophysics with LIGO's events. And so now I'm out of time, so I just want to mention very, very briefly some of the tests of general relativity, just basically to kind of motivate some questions or discussion later if you are interested in this stuff. So our models are built from a combination of this kind of post-Newtonian approximation for the inspiral part of the waveform, fits to numerical relativity simulations at merger, and then the kind of quasi-normal modes, this ringing down of the final black hole to a steady state Kerr solution. And the production of those models is complicated. We don't have a kitchen sink model yet that we think incorporates all of the physics that's really important for constraining these things. So far, we've gotten lucky again in that nature has produced binary systems that are in a well-explored part of the parameter space where we think systematics are well under control. And so our systematic uncertainties are less than our statistical. So for now, we can use our models to really do meaningful constraints on deviations from general relativity. One way we can go about this is the other form of the reconstructions that I had promised. So this here is whitened data in gray in the background. And in dark blue is the unmodeled constraint on the signal for GW150914. And in cyan is the model, the compact binary assumption from GR constraint on the signal. And so the fact that these two overlay one another across the whole duration of the signal is a strong statement, kind of a nice illustration of how consistent this signal is with a compact binary coalescence, a binary black hole merger, as described by general relativity. If we make that assumption, or if we make no assumption about signal morphology, we get a very consistent reconstruction of the signal. And so this is, you can think of as one way to do kind of broad constraints on deviations from GR. And we can do much better, more precise parametric ones if we have the motivation. And I can kind of talk to you more about that afterward if you're interested. I had mentioned the wavelet reconstruction. So this is kind of one illustration of how the wavelets could be used to reconstruct GW150914. And this is about 7 wavelets in here. So then another way we can measure deviations from GR is instead of making a strong, so we can make a model dependent statement. We can say that, for example, we expect deviations from GR to happen at specific post-Newtonian orders. And so we can basically put in parameters into our model, which are deviations from GR at given PN orders, and put constraints on those individual deviations from the GR prediction. And that's something that we do in the testing GR paper, and we put actual quantitative bounds on each of those deviations at the post-Newtonian terms. Another way we can go about it is we assume nothing about how deviations from GR happen, and we just make a statistical statement about how consistent residuals are with the noise in the instruments. And so this is where I was contributing. So what we did was we took the best fit waveform from the full parameter estimation analysis of GW150914. We subtracted it from the data, and then we ran the unmodeled search on the residuals. And so what we're doing is putting a constraint on the residual coherent power left in the detectors after we model their best prediction from general relativity. And so this line here is the cumulative distribution of running that analysis on chunks of known noise near the time of the event. So there was no gravitational waves subtracted from this data. This is just noise in the instruments and showing what the cumulative distribution is on the recovered SNR, the upper bound, the 95% upper bound on the residual SNR and just known noise. And then the dashed line is the result of running that analysis after subtracting GW150914 and running on the residuals. And so we basically are just making a statement that the residuals, if we assume GR is correct, are consistent with surrounding chunks of noise using this particular method. There's more robust ways we can go about doing this, and we can fold into account systematic uncertainties if we can quantify them from our models. And so that's something else I've been working on with a grad student at University of Chicago. And I'll save this for later discussion later on if people are interested. But basically using the same kind of Gaussian process framework, but using it to build an emulator for numerical relativity simulations. So being able to produce not just a waveform at a given set of masses and spins, but a waveform with uncertainties that we can then forward propagate those systematic uncertainties in the model through to our final parameter estimation for masses and spins. So if that's something that you're interested in, please find me later and I'd love to talk more about it. But with that, I will jump to the future. So there's a definite need for fundamental parameter estimation. We're going to have hundreds of black holes in the very near future. And so we want to do things. We need to get good parameter estimation of individual sources. We need to get inference of the underlying population and start using that to do interesting astrophysics. So once we do that, we can get really, we can start to disentangle these formation channels, and it starts to get really exciting. And then finally, we need better modeling and better quantification of uncertainties in our models to do really good tests of general relativity and to do novel analyses of the data to look for deviations from GR. So with that, I will take any remaining questions you have. Thank you.
So it's a question about the statistical methodology you use to assess what the outcome is for non-zero spin, for example.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you've considered using model selection tools like the IP information criterion.
So we have used some information criteria to do these measurements. So the one that we actually put numbers for in the papers is the deviance information criteria. And so we've done some information criteria to do model selection statements, especially not so much for spin versus no spin, but for precession versus spin aligned. And so that's something we actually already have to some level in our papers.
And what do you find? Is there evidence that you need those extra parameters? You know,
so far, it's not very definitive. There's hints that it looks like there's reason to, especially for GW151226, to need the extra parameters to describe the spin, and that's consistent with that kind of rather precise constraint of the spin magnitude and spin tilt being a little bit away from zero for GW151226. But it's not, I wouldn't say, very definitive yet. And so with the population, as we get more than just three detections, then it starts to get interesting.
When you say it's consistent with that, the puzzle, because I would have thought that, you know, maybe assuming that you have, you know, six parameters for spin tells you, okay, that most likely spin is here. But something like one of these information criteria could tell you, well, those extra six parameters didn't improve the goodness of spin enough to actually warrant a spin at all. And so you don't actually have good reason to say that there's any spin.
Well, so the reason I say it's not definitive is that it's kind of, what's your threshold for the information criteria to decide when it is actually definitive or not? So I mean, in terms of the deviance information criteria, lower is better, right? And so with the precession allowed for GW151226, so giving that degree of freedom of the spin tilt for the primary objects, the deviance information criteria is higher by a few. But you can debate on whether you think that's interesting or not yet. And so that's why I say it's kind of marginal at this point.
In the simulation as well as in the discussion, till the two black holes merge, they retain their identities.
So after, okay, sorry.
Is there any situation, anything which is constraining breaking apart a black hole? Maybe it's a stupid question.
So breaking apart black holes?
Yeah, before they collide, before they merge.
Is there any reason to think that these black holes could inspiral but not merge and kind of fling apart?
Yeah.
So I would say no. There's no theoretical reasons to believe yet that we could actually have two. One thing to highlight, which I didn't mention, is that we had 15 parameters for the binary system, and that is because we assume there's no eccentricity left. So through basically every formation channel we can imagine, we think that any eccentricity that would be present in the binary, by the time they get to the band of LIGO sensitivity, would have radiated away any eccentricity, and they're basically circular orbits. So especially in the scenario of circular orbits, there's no reason to think that these things, if they're inspiraling into one another, won't just result in one final steady state Kerr black hole at the end.
But like, naively think in terms of two droplets colliding against each other, they can break apart. So there is some physics which is holding the identity of black holes before they merge. Is there any?
Black hole cannot fission unless it forms
a singularity.
Right.
So black hole cannot fission. There is some.
It can only do it, but leaving aside the negative singularity. That would be awesome.
I see.
Okay.
So,
John, last question.
So I was just wondering, so let's say you do have, you know, 80 detections or something, and you do start to measure this feather distribution well.
Yep.
I was wondering if you could say a little more about what that might tell you about different population synthesis scenarios, besides just, you know, if it's isotropic, maybe it's clusters or non-isotropic.
Yeah. So and the thing I was really highlighting is being able to separate generically just field formation from cluster formation. That's kind of the lowest hanging fruit. What gets really interesting is, like you said, kind of going into the kind of nuts and bolts of the population inference, or sorry, the population synthesis side of things. So now, okay, we have at least some component of the underlying population is coming from field formation. We have behemoth codes that produce, given all of these, all of the relevant physics, we think, common envelope phases, stellar evolution. We can go from the basic physics to the final population of binaries that LIGO detects. And so we can presumably start to put interesting constraints on common envelope physics, on other things within population synthesis if we can start to separate out the field population. So I didn't talk much about that because it's definitely going to be a challenging thing to do. There's a whole lot of knobs and levers and sliders in population synthesis code, and there's motivation for some of those choices, but there's a whole lot of unknown physics that goes on in those simulations. And so right now we're in a scenario where if we can give, we can say we can put a very tight constraint on the mass function just from LIGO detections without any kind of prior input from physical mechanisms like population synthesis. If we give a very certain constraint on masses, it wouldn't be very hard for population synthesis codes, given some tweaks that are totally plausible with known measurements, to be able to produce basically any generic mass distribution you give them. So why I focused on spins is that it's a little bit harder, it's a lot harder actually to be able to produce fine details that come out of spin measurements with a generic population synthesis code versus cluster codes. But eventually, as we get more mature, we hope to be able to actually do more than just separate these two channels in the relative rates, but actually learn interesting physics within population synthesis. And so that's something that's going to be in the medium future, I would say, but it's definitely an exciting avenue.
Okay, John, more questions? Sorry, John, and then,
just getting back to the question about the very nice perfect signal.
Yes.
We have a blind projection going on.
Yep.
So how could it possibly be that you can have a blind projection, a malicious projection, occur for both and for the malicious? The speed of light low. So
you're asking how we could meaningfully do a blind simulation of a in both detectors. So we just it's not picking a time at random. It's beforehand picking basically a geocenter time for the gravitational wave and a sky position, and then given our ability to actually precisely measure at a GPS time when to inject that signal, we can do it within that kind of uncertainty. So we can definitely model milliseconds of a delay between two instruments.
How do you know 100% if it's not a blind injection?
So there's a bunch of different ways. So first of all, when we do a blind injection, it's done in hardware. So we actually physically wobble a mirror in the detectors to simulate the effect of a gravitational wave going through. So we have channels that record the servos that control that wobbling at all times. They're under lock and key. We can't just, any member of the collaboration can't just look at those channels, but the higher management can look at those channels, and they have and shown that we definitely didn't do a blind injection, intentional or otherwise, at the time of the event. And so then there's a whole avenue to go down, which is the malicious injection of things. So people doing it maliciously, trying to go under the radar, and so there's tons of investigations into that as well.
Yeah.
And
it's the Russians, right?
Yeah. So there's no evidence whatsoever. We can put pretty meaningful a statement about the probability of a blind or a malicious injection, and it's low. Basically, there's all kinds of environmental channels, even seismometers at the end stations and microphones in the control room, so that we could have seen when people came and tampered with machinery to put in some kind of piece of electronics to simulate an injection. We did a surprising amount of searching into methods for that, and basically there's no reason to think that there was a malicious injection done.
Just one comment. So you said that, okay, the first signal was very much like a Mardi Gras. The second as well was very much like what the Mardi Gras.
Yes.
Except that it was much further up. Take the second signal and put it four times closer, and it would have looked like the first one, or vice versa. So there is absolutely no problem. Nature was kind to us in that it happened earlier. And I'm going to disagree when you say, well, nature is never kind. Nature has been kind so many times. Right? The Beta satellite, the Russians were doing it.
Nature picks and chooses this kind.
Right. Sometimes we actually do get lucky. Many times we have gotten lucky.
No, we can talk later.
Okay, great. All right, thank you.